Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experiences of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything. We were talking last time about tithing and the fourth tithe, which is the sabbatical tithe, resting the land, forgiving debts. And you were really enthusiastic about that one because it really sums up everything you're about, isn't it? About honouring the land, nurturing the land, and understanding that you have to rest it instead of just throwing more muck at it for another year and doing it all again.
Mm, if only it was muck, throwing more chemicals at it.
Down here it's muck, I can
assure
you.
Down here it's muck, yes. Thank heavens. Yes, I mean, I was actually really moved by the tithes. They sound very beautiful and they sound like that they come from a place where the people who are writing these things down understand that the earth is sacred and that the earth is part of the body of God or the goddess, whatever you ascribe as being the kind of the foundation of matter was clearly sacred to these people to a degree. Because that's one of the things that I just don't get about not just Christianity really, but is that the degree of separation that there is between what's perceived as the human world and the rest of the world.
I think a lot of that came in with what was known as the Enlightenment, the start of science and rational thinking. And there's great stuff in science. Of course there is. But the worst thing that they did, I think, was they started talking about the mind of God, which limited God down to a mind. You know, and a mind has opinions. And it was just a really difficult way of putting God in a box away from humanity. Mm-hmm. In a funny way, I can't describe it any better than that, but that was the point at which we started the Industrial Revolution after that, in the Northern Hemisphere, certainly. And it all became how important we were.
Yeah.
And we've become so distanced from the land. I mean, you still ask many a child nowadays, where does meat come from? And they're going to tell you Sainsbury's. Other supermarkets provide meat. As does your local butcher.
Yes. Well done. you're probably right. Although my suspicion is that it's not quite as simple as that, simply because the world in which science evolved, in order for science to pursue that kind of separatist notion, there had to be a sense of separation beforehand, or it...
That's it true. Just, why did it happen?
Yeah.
Because, yes, I think you're right, the sense of separation was... I think one of the problems was cities.
Yeah.
On the one hand, civilization, which is the aspect of us which is supposed to be working at the level of the soul, is a great idea because the idea is to work in harmony. But when you get large amounts of populations and shove them in a city and disconnect them from the land, you can't expect them to understand it if they don't know what the chain is. In the old days, even though the landlords and the lords and the ladies may have been utter ratbags, they were still connected to the land. Yeah. And one of the reasons why I'm not a fervent opponent of fox hunting, which people think I should be, is because it's part of the cycle of the land. It's part of the... it's dangerous. You're actually going out there and challenging. You're riding a horse and you are pursuing a fox to protect the sheep, the lambs. Now, you're going to disagree with me, and that's absolutely fine, because I'm not saying I'm right. I'm just saying I'm not a fervent opponent on it, for the simple reason that when we moved down here, it was just after the fox hunting ban came on, and the farmers around us lost more than 40 lambs. Mm. Because foxes had actually been brought in from the cities and deposited.
And, wow, cheeky.
Mm-hmm. I think it was Bristol, but I can't confirm that. But there were certainly a lot more foxes, feral foxes, that had been living in towns that were brought out and dumped on Dartmoor and Exmoor. Wow. And there was no hunt. And, of course, they were desperately hungry.
Mm.
So that year was not a good year. But I think my point is that even though the landlords may have been wicked and evil and superior or whatever, some of them may also have been very good, they were all still in touch with the land. It all depended on what the harvest brought.
Mm.
And once we went into cities, we just got disconnected, maybe?
Maybe. I don't know. I mean, the word city and civilization have the same root, don't they? Mm. Civitas. And once upon a time, the cities will have been really clear that you know, lunch came because a farmer brought it rather than because they could pop along to quick mention a different one, say, Morrison's. And that I think disconnection from the land, yes, of course, it's got to do with the Industrial Revolution, and of course, it's got to do with the age of supposed enlightenment, and of course, it's got to do with our enormously kind of lengthening of the chain between what grows and actually getting to eat it, which are all because of those things. But primarily, surely, the absolutely fundamental one is that there are so many of us that old thing of 2 acres and a cow, which is what I think it takes, it might be 3 acres and a cow, actually, can't quite remember, what will support a household. But then we've also forgotten that a household used to be extended family, not mummy, daddy and 2.2 children. It was an extensive extended family. And that the countryside now, we look at the countryside and we go, you know, oh, isn't it beautiful? Isn't it mercifully empty of people? But it didn't used to be. Before 2/3 of the people of the world lived in cities or whatever it is, there were many more people in the countryside. Mm. Even though there were many less people, each bit of countryside will have had many more occupants, which is what, you know, seem like inconceivable feats now, like the building of all the dry stone walls, for example. That's what made it possible. There were lots of people doing lots of things. So, you know, yes, you are almost certainly right. It was the taking of the people out of the land. But I think it's a deliberate taking, it seems to me, rather than a willing migration. There was, you know, if you go back again, I think we've been here before, to the clearances and
the enclosures.
And the enclosures and all the rest of it, that you know, we very swiftly find ourselves in a place where the very few are seeking that thing that is or is not the root of all evil above the welfare of their fellow man.
And yes, so, and they're seeking it beyond what is needed.
Indeed.
Which is what the whole teaching is about. Well, we'll never really know the reason why, but your work is the honouring of the land. So what can we do now? What is needed now? What do you do? What can we learn? How can we get back?
How can we get back? Well, I guess, as with everything, it depends. It's the answer to every question.
Cool.
I've decided.
Yes, and.
Yes, and. So it depends, in a way, it depends how far are you from the place where you understand that you are simply one amongst the many that make up the body of Gaia. And that literally every aspect of everything we do, eat, think, say, wear, live in, live on, etc., etc., is part of the body of the divine. And so as soon as you've gone to that place of, I want more than is sufficient, you've stepped out of what, you know, I think, is it a Buddhist expression, right relationship? I love it. You've stepped out of right relationship with the living, breathing, sentient, ensouled earth. Because you're trying to take more than is your fair share. And so step one, whether you've got access to land or not, you know, you could live in a high rise in the middle of Birmingham or, you know, anywhere, places that I can't even conceive of because I'm so city averse. And still really, truly honour your connection to land and life, both of which have a capital L in this particular instance, because they are that which sustains us, by simply not having a bigger one, a better one, a newer one, a faster one, a shinier one, a pinker one, whatever it is. Because most of us, not all of us, I'm very fully aware that it doesn't apply to all of us, even in the West, we don't all have enough already. And, you know, too many people have far from enough. But altogether, too many of us have got more than enough, the kind of quantities of over the level of what ought to be enough that are really quite sickening. And so, although you say it makes no difference to you if whoever it was gets even richer, it kind of does, because by the ever enriching of the rich, there is, although energetically there's not less soup in the pot, just mechanistically speaking, in terms of what's available, if a tiny percentage have got more and more and more and more of the resources, there are, just by sure, you know, play school maths, less of those resources for the rest of us.
When it comes to resources, yes, because you've taken it into the physical. Yeah. But the thing about money is it doesn't exist.
No, exactly.
Less than 2% of it is physical.
Yeah.
The rest of it is an agreement between computers. So actually it's mentally and emotionally controlled.
Yeah, yeah, but I'm actually not talking about...
No, I understand. Yeah, no, the
non-material money. I'm talking about in the physical world, the physical acquisition of more than we physically need is one of the ways in which we dishonour the land and life. And I'm so not Marie Kondo. I'm not suggesting that we should all go and, you know, clear out our clutter and live very acerbic kind of... Is that the right word?
Aesthetic.
Aesthetic, yes.
But probably acerbic if it's Marie Kondo. Yes.
No offence.
Other feng shui practitioners and clear clutter people may also apply.
I don't. I mean, I know her name and tell I know approximately what she does.
Tell me what you do when you get up in the morning. Do you have a ritual to honour the earth?
Yeah, I've got lots. So when I get up in the morning, almost the first thing I do is go outside of my front door and just breathe in the gloriousness. So this morning, that moment was at 5 a.m, courtesy of my very aged dog who woke me up because she needs help getting up. So I took her out for a wee in the garden, and at 5 a.m, the cacophony of the dawn chorus has to be witnessed to be believed. And I just breathe it in as such an extraordinary blessing of, wow, life is, in my particular case, so extraordinarily beautiful. And I feel so much gratitude for every single dawn, every single morning, every one of those birds that's singing. Then, as you by now know, savage addiction to hot drinks kicks in. Off I totter to put the kettle on the stove. And at some point shortly thereafter, once I'm outside of a cup of tea, I will go and do one of a number of practices which all involve placing myself within a living web of life. So it might be, very briefly, that I might undertake a practice which I think lots of people would recognise if I called it the Seven Directions of the Warrior, or it's known amongst Native Americans as the Beauty Way. I'm not sure where it came from as a practice, but it seems to exist in almost every culture. And it's basically you are acknowledging and honouring and feeling into and learning about your relationship with above me, below me, before me, behind me, to my right, to my left, and within. And you don't do it at that rambling rate. You do it very, very slowly and carefully, feeling your way outwards from, or I do, from my place, standing in my body, as far down as I can go, as far up as I can go, as far in front of me as I can go, as far behind me as I can go. And I do it on so many levels. So on the one hand, I have an ongoing challenge for, in my particular case, I tend to do it standing outside my front door, and in front of me is my front gate. And beyond the front gate, still in that direction approximately, is my path, which leads out into the farmyard and down the road and stuff. And so I've used it as an invitation to, in front of me, how far can I get before I meet somebody who I cannot name? And by somebody, I might mean insects, flowers, leaves, trees, creatures, but also human neighbours, anyone. How far can I get before I'm in the unknown, as it were? Mm. And then when I meet somebody who is unknown, can I find out about them? So, you know, for example, one of the very first things I ever found out about once doing this practice was goatweed. It's got lots of other names, and I can't think of any of them in this moment. But anyway, when it's a teeny weeny weeny little weed, it's absolutely delicious. But not, it's not bindweed. People hate it. It's that thing.
We call it sweetheart. Cleavers.
No, not cleavers. Oh. No, this thing grows under the ground. It's incredibly vociferous and prolific. Gardeners hate it because if you leave even a tiniest bit behind, it will regenerate. Ground elder. So ground elder. Ground elder's delicious.
Oh.
If you eat it when it's
damn, we don't have any.
Kind of lucky you, but also not. If you eat it when it's that absolutely mega vibrant bright green that it first sprouts out, it is absolutely delicious. And even when it's big, it's, you know, it's up there with all those other things like dandelion leaves and all the rest of it that are just as good for you as spinach. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you don't need to go to any of the aforementioned purveyors of foodstuffs to find it because it's in your garden already. And that, so that, you know, that also is an ongoing process of falling in love with, mm-hmm. through knowledge, that which I'm surrounded by. And so it's mm-hmm. not a romantic kind of, you know,
it's not hello clouds, hello sky, hello sun.
No, it's really not. Mm. And it's not, oh, look, you know, I live in the itsy ditsy shire and it's also very pretty witty and look at the teeny weeny lanes or whatever. You know, I'm not being nasty, I hope. Maybe I am just a tiny bit, but apologies.
Well, no, you're not being nasty. We're both what Kabbalah would call gevurik, which is the standpoint of the divine feminine, which is enough now. No more excuses. This can be done. Mm. And you're doing it in the countryside. I now live in the countryside. But I think, in a funny kind of way, I learned to do it in the town. So one of the most annoying things about me is I always say to people, it can be done wherever you are. Whatever it is you need to do can be done in your mind's eye, in your heart and in your soul. I've been annoying other Christians during the lockdown because they're saying, I can't have communion. I say, of course you can have communion. And they say, no, he hasn't been sanctified by a priest. And I'm going, yeah, when Jesus died, the veil of the temple was torn, which was a signal that you could get direct contact with the divine. You know, it's okay. I don't want people going around saying, I've consecrated bread for you to eat.
Mm.
I want them to say, this bread is already consecrated because it comes from the divine. And if I put a blessing on it to make, I can eat bread myself and consider these things. And that's not perhaps a very good example, but the one I would give is, well, after my now ex and I came back from a year in Montana, which was a very extraordinary experience to talk about another time. That was living in a sacred valley in Bozeman, surrounded by seven ranges of mountains. And oh, it really was the most incredible place. But when we came back, we were totally broke. The whole business venture had been utter disaster, completely our own fault. We were up in the air with it all. And I came back, I was completely broke, broken, shamed. The marriage was dying. I'd got out of kilter with all my previous methods of employment. So the only way I could make the rent for the little basement apartment we were in the centre of London was to peel potatoes in a pub.
Wow.
You know, peel vegetables. And I'm sitting there thinking, I've directed live television. You know, I've But that's one of the most important things there was the humility,
mm-hmm.
of saying, I am grateful that I get to pay to peel potatoes in a pub. Mm. And in fact, the seminal day was the day that I was on early duty peeling stuff in the pub, and I was supposed to be helping the chef who was cooking breakfast, but he'd been drunk the night before and didn't show up. So I'm sitting there sorting out the vegetables and cutting the chips because people want chips for their breakfast. Goodness knows why, but they did. And I got 17 orders for breakfast. So that was another useful one, which was, you've directed live television. You can cook 17 breakfasts. I do have to put my hand on my heart here and say I'm terribly sorry, vegetarians. I did sometimes accidentally use the same frying pan, and I'm really sorry, but it was a panic-stricken morning. But what also happened that morning was that they delivered a new oven, and the kitchen in that pub was upstairs, and they tried to get the oven up the stairs, and they couldn't, and they blocked the stairs. So I was trapped in that kitchen for 9 hours. Couldn't get out, couldn't get over it. No lavatory, had to use the sink and all that kind of thing. And I was just sitting in that kitchen. Okay, I cooked lunch. But sitting in that kitchen, the only thing I could see was the sky through a skylight. And that was the seminal part of the start of the healing for me, because I sat in that kitchen and I wept. Because everything was over. Everything has ended. I hadn't got my dog back at that point. I did get a bat. That was the other miracle. But so I was just sitting, broken, shamed, in that kitchen, and there was the sky and clouds going across it and some blue sky. And in the end, even though I didn't know that much about meditation then, I just sat and looked at that sky and adored it. And to start with, I was actually thinking slightly suicidal thoughts, but by the end of it, I'd connected with something. So there really isn't an excuse.
No. Well, I mean, that to me, that's the point, if you like. Perhaps that's the wrong thing to say. Anyway, it's blah, 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 blah. Sorry, babbling. So that sky and the patch of ground upon which that pub stands is as sacred ground as the valley surrounded by seven mountains, because there is no ground that is not sacred. It is all the body of the goddess.
Yes.
And that's the thing, you know, there's no... I don't think people are looking for excuses, but I think they see problems. And that, you know, the problem that you're in a high rise wherever, maybe, you know, maybe there isn't anyone in a high rise anywhere going, but I don't, you know, I haven't got access to Dartmoor, I can't do it. That land was once as wild, as exquisitely beautiful, as overtly sacred as the land of the moor. Yes. And that it's been, you know, treated differently over time, and it has potentially been, you know, disrespected perhaps by far greater a number of degrees, but it's still there. You know, in London alone there are countless, I know somebody's counted them, but to me uncountable numbers of rivers under the city of London, sacred streams, waters, living water running under the city of London. And although that's not what comes out of your tap when you turn it on in London anymore, they are still there. They can still be connected with, as exactly as you described, through your will, through your imagination, through your breath. And that the idea that in order to start to act in reciprocity with the earth requires you to go and be somewhere beautiful in the countryside is just rubbish. I'm sorry. And actually, in many ways, you've got far more power to change the paradigm in a city than you have in the country. Because in the country, you're not particularly noticeable if you're going around singing with wells and laughing with trees and greeting the dawn and all that. Imagine if everybody started doing that in London. If somebody's, you know, sitting by a roadside somewhere along Pall Mall, I don't know if there's a well on Pall Mall, but singing to the well, because the water is sacred, because it is the living blood of our mother.
I know Holy someone who's hell. Doing that.
You do?
I do. Her name's Jennifer Kavanagh. She's an author and a Quaker. She lives in London. And she's walking the parks every day singing.
Yay!
Singing out loud. And of course, people are stopping her and talking to her.
Glorious. I rest my case.
Yes. Yes. And this actually, what you have highlighted is the problem I see with religion, mm-hmm. is the segregation of the sacred and the profane.
Yeah.
Either everything is sacred or nothing is.
Yeah.
Which is why you can consecrate your own bread for communion. Because Jesus wasn't ordained. The disciples weren't ordained. St. Paul wasn't ordained. It became something that somebody did to you. And somebody who'd squabbled with me a long time ago and probably still hasn't forgiven me, I'm sorry, John Padley, I still don't know what I did, but I am sorry, wouldn't come to my ordination. He sent me a kind of snippy email saying, I don't think people need to be ordained, which is absolutely true. Mm. He's actually right about that. And I took it up for the reasons we went into. But this idea that you are given the right to consecrate bread or consecrate something or to say that something is sacred or not. No, you own the right.
It's
your birthright. And the right is that if you consider something not to be sacred, make it so. To misquote Catherine, Captain Picard, make it so. You know, if something appears to be not sacred, it is sacred, it's just forgotten. Mm. So I think the reminding in cities, reminding the land that it is still the land, even if we built all over it. It knows it's still the land, but it may be getting a bit confused.
But also, you know, back to the... I can't remember. Sorry, I've rambled on about so many different things in this room today that I can't remember whether I was talking to you or not. But one of my current boxes of oranges to stand on, soap boxes, is this idea that words are spells, mm. and that we, by the way, at the most basic level, by the way we name our world, but by the way we speak of her, we, in a way, desacralize her,
sacredize her, whatever. We know what you mean.
Yeah. And that the kind of the revivification that's required for our relationship with all of the rest of life, with the sacred, and ultimately with ourselves, is that we remember that how we speak about something is, it defines what it becomes to us. Mm. And so, for example, there's in another book, oh my goodness, one of the most beautiful books I've ever read is a book called Braiding Sweetgrass by a woman called Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's a Native American elder and also a mainstream scientist-ish, not probably very considered mainstream anymore, but that's where she began. And it's a just exquisite book for more reasons than I could possibly name, and I very heartily encourage you to read it. Anyway, in it, she points out that if you see a tree, so she was probably talking about something like the giant redwoods, but I conceive of it as being the ash. If you come up to an ash tree or an oak tree, and that tree is an it, you can take a chainsaw, you can chop it down, you can put it in your fire, you can build your boat with it, whatever, you can send it off to the logging man, put it on a trolley, blah blah blah, all those things. If it's he or she, that is very significantly harder. If you see that the people of the trees, so the standing nation, I think they're called in Native American society, and I've said the words Native American a lot today, and my spirituality is not Native American, no. And I do not for one second subscribe to the notion that theirs is the only culture that remembers these ways, but it happens to be that she's a Native American and she says it so beautifully. I derailed myself.
We go off in a different direction, but it's true. If you make it an object, a thing, and also we make ourselves these demigods, it must serve me. Mm. And actually the life of understanding the divine is a life of service to the divine, in the divine, part of the divine, and understanding that you are an integral part of this life force.
Exactly. And that it's it's not that everything is in service to me, and neither is it that I am in servitude to everything else.
No, service and servitude, so different, yes.
So different. And so that there's not, you know, there is never an invitation to be, you know, in servitude, in that kind of, you know, I'll do anything and I won't cut down any trees and I won't step on any beetles, or I'm not deriding that as a, as an attitude from the cutting down trees and the stepping on beetles. But I think it's really important that we realise that everything is important. Everything's alive, interwoven, interconnected. And so the oak is no more or less important than I am. Mm-hmm. But also that we both have our thread, as it were. We both have our place. And that there is a way of living which does so much less harm than our way. And it doesn't have to be, you know, there's, I'm not one of these people saying, oh, we should all go back to the Stone Age and that's how we can exist on this planet and do no harm. Because
we can't.
Well, we can't. No, it's just not practical and no one's going to do it, are they? There is, I've got friends who have all kinds of amazing Stone Age skills, and you don't need to do it to
shop at certain supermarkets that should go on there.
Yeah, and you don't need to do it for very long to understand why it is that we choose to farm and live in homes. You know, it's bloody hard. Mm. But that what we can do is, if we stand in the place where everything is sacred and everything must be taken into consideration, and we are prepared to step out of what's easy and what's comfortable and most, to my mind, kind of despicable in some ways of all, what is convenient, that if we're prepared to make some effort to do no harm, then we can live in a very, very different way. But it doesn't mean we have to live without comfort and warmth and communication and all the rest of it, because it boils down to the really, really basic notions of freedom, is that we are all free to do as we please, as long as us doing as we please doesn't impinge on someone else doing what they please. And that, therefore, a truly generous, loving, authentic, ensouled life has got to be a series of compromises between my freedom and the freedom of all else that lives to exist. And so there's some jostling, yes. There's some give and take.
I keep thinking I need to tell a particular story to close, so I think I will. I was at a comedy festival in Bath a few years ago, drove home very late at night and came off the roundabout to come onto the old A30 to drive to our home. And there was this golden thing on the side of the road, obviously been hit by a car, and it was big. I thought it was a dog, so I stopped the car immediately, got out, and it was a hare. It's beautiful golden hair, still warm, quite dead. And I looked at, I thought, my God, I don't think I've ever seen anything or held anything. Well, of course I have. I've got dogs and things like that. But I was holding this hair in my arms, thinking how beautiful it was. And I thought, I cannot leave you here by the side of the road. The only way I can honour you, and this may sound really awful, is put you in the boot, take you home, learn how to skin and gut you, cook you and eat you, and give thanks for every single moment of your life. I'd never eaten hare before in my life. It was a real palaver. I had to go onto YouTube and get a video and cut, you know, and I butchered this hare. It, in worship and gratitude and thanks with life. And it seemed like a sacred thing to do to make sure its death was not wasted because somebody going too fast had just hit a hare.
Yeah.
And I couldn't let that lie. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's all things like that. There's it's just, I'm so committed to the idea of, and the statement that it depends. So sometimes, clearly on that day for you, and hopefully for that hare, that was exactly and exquisitely the right thing to do. And I must say that for me, when things have been hit on the side of the road, leaving them on the side of the road is never the right thing to do because it's so, I don't know, it just feels so profoundly disrespectful.
Well, how would we feel if our grandma
was left on the side of the road? Yeah. Exactly. But, you know, then on the other hand, if everything is sacred, then the side of the road is also sacred. But there's another argument that says, to be placed perhaps over the hedge, where you can gently moulder away in the land of your ancestors.
Or feed other animals.
Or feed the crows, might be equally as good an outcome. And I really genuinely don't think it's possible to ever make a judgment call on that outside of the moment.
No, exactly.
Yeah.
But it's the same with everything. If it's in the present moment, really, you know what to do. There's another Kabbalistic saying I love, which is the decision cannot be made until the decision is ready to be made. And that's in the moment. And when people say to me, I don't know what to do, I don't want to do, I say, well, it's not time to make the decision then, because when it is, you'll know. Even if you just run out of options, you'll know.
Yeah.
Enough?
I don't know. What's the time?
It's your mistress 34 time, minutes. I'm mistress of the time.
Mistress of the time. I believe it's up, so to speak.
We'll see you next time.